resides. No more and no less.
So power is a mummer's trick. A shadow on the wall, Varys murmured.
Yet shadows can kill, and oft-times a very small man can cast a very large shadow.
Tyrion smiled.
Lord Varys, I'm growing strangely fond of you. I may kill you yet, but I think I'd feel sad about it.
I will take that as high praise.
What are you, Varys? Tyrion found he truly wanted to know.
A spider, they say.
Spies and informers are seldom loved, my lord. I am but a loyal servant of the realm.
And a eunuch? Let us not forget that.
I seldom do.
People have called me a half-man, too. Yet I think the guards have been kinder to me. I am small, my legs are twisted, and women do not look upon me with any great yearning. And yet I'm still a man. Shay is not the first to grace my bed, and one day I may take a wife and sire a son. If the guards are good, he'll look like his uncle and think like his father. You have no such hope to sustain you. Dwarfs are a jape of the guards, but men make eunuchs. Who cut you, Varys? When and why? Who are you, truly?
The eunuch's smile never flickered, but his eyes glittered with something that was not laughter.
You are kind to ask, my lord, but my tale is long and sad, and we have treasons to discuss.
He drew a parchment from the sleeve of his robe.
The master of the king's galley, White Hart, plots to slip anchor 3 days hence to offer his sword and ship to Lord Stannis.
Tyrion sighed.
I suppose we must make some sort of bloody lesson out of the man.
Sir Jaslyn could arrange for him to vanish, but a trial before the king would help assure the continued loyalty of the other captains.
And keep my royal nephew occupied as well. As you say, put him down for a dose of Joffrey's justice.
Varys made a mark on the parchment.
Sir Horace and Sir Hobber Redwine have bribed a guard to let them out of a postern gate the night after next. Arrangements have been made for them to sail on the Pentoshi galley Moonrunner, disguised as oarsmen.
Can we keep them on those oars for a few years? See how they fancy it? He smiled.
No, my sister would be distraught to lose such treasured guests.
Inform Sir Jaslyn, seize the man they bribed, and explain what an honor it is to serve as a brother of the Night's Watch. And have men posted around Moonrunner in case the Red Wines find a second guard short of coin.
As you will.
Another mark on the parchment.
Your man, Timid, slew a wine seller's son this evening at a gambling den on the Street of Silver. He accused him of cheating at tiles.
Was it true?
Oh, beyond a doubt.
Then the honest men of the city owe Timid a debt of gratitude. I shall see that he has the king's thanks.
The eunuch gave a nervous giggle and made another mark.
We also have a sudden plague of holy men. The comet has brought forth all manner of queer priests, preachers, and prophets, it would seem. They beg in the wine sinks and pot shops and foretell doom and destruction to anyone who stops to listen.
Tyrion shrugged. We are close on the 300th year since Aegon's landing.
I suppose it's only to be expected.
Let them rant. They are spreading fear, my lord.
I thought that was your job.
Varys covered his mouth with his hand.
You are very cruel to say so. One last matter. Lady Tender gave a small supper last night. I have the menu and the guest list for your inspection.
When the wine was poured, Lord Giles rose to lift a cup to the king, and Sir Balon Swan was heard to remark, "We'll need three cups for that." Many laughed.
Tyrion raised a hand.
"Enough. Sir Balon made a jest. I'm not interested in treasonous table talk, Lord Varys."
"You are as wise as you are gentle, my lord." The parchment vanished up the eunuch's sleeve.
"We both have much to do. I shall leave you."
When the eunuch had departed, Tyrion sat for a long time watching the candle and wondering how his sister would take the news of Janus Slynt's dismissal. Not happily, if he was any judge, but beyond sending an angry protest to Lord Tywin in Harrenhal, he did not see what Cersei could hope to do about it. Tyrion had the city watch now, plus 100.5 fierce clansmen and a growing force of sellswords recruited by Bronn. He would seem well protected. Doubtless, Eddard Stark thought the same. The Red Keep was dark and still when Tyrion left the small hall. Bronn was waiting in his solar.
"Slynt?" he asked.
"Lord Janus will be sailing for the Wall on the morning tide. Varys would have me believe that I have replaced one of Joffrey's men with one of my own. More likely, I have replaced Littlefinger's man with one belonging to Varys. But so be it."
"You'd best know Timmick killed a man. Varys told me."
The sellsword seemed unsurprised.
"The fool figured a one-armed man will be easier to cheat. Timmick pinned his wrist to the table with a dagger and ripped out his throat barehanded. He has this trick where he stiffens his fingers. Spare me the grisly details. My supper is sitting badly in my belly," Tyrion said. "How goes your recruiting?"
"Well enough. 3 new men tonight."
"How do you know which ones to hire?"
"I look them over. I'll question them to learn where they fought and how well they lie," Bronn smiled. "And then I give them a chance to kill me while I do the same for them."
"Have you killed any?"
"No one we could have used."
"And if one of them kills you?"
"He'll be the one you'll want to hire."
Tyrion was a little drunk and very tired.
"Tell me, Bronn, if I told you to kill a babe, an infant girl, say, still at her mother's breast, would you do it without question?"
"Without question? No."
The sellsword rubbed thumb and forefinger together.
"I'd ask how much."
"And why would I ever need your Al-Ardeen, Lord Slynt?"
Tyrion thought.
"I have 100 of my own."
He wanted to laugh. He wanted to weep. Most of all, he wanted Shay. Arya. The road was little more than 2 ruts through the weeds. The good part was, with so little traffic, there'd be no one to point the finger and say which way they'd gone. The human flood that had flowed down the King's Road was only a trickle here. The bad part was the road wound back and forth like a snake, tangling with even smaller trails, and sometimes seeming to vanish entirely, only to reappear 0.5 a league farther on, when they had all but given up hope. Arya hated it. The land was gentle enough, rolling hills and terraced fields, interspersed with meadows and woodlands, and little valleys where willows crowded close to slow, shallow streams. Even so, the path was so narrow and crooked that their pace had dropped to a crawl. It was the wagons that slowed them, lumbering along, axles creaking under the weight of their heavy loads. 12 times a day they had to stop to free a wheel that had stuck in a rut, or double up the teams to climb a muddy slope. Once, in the middle of a dense stand of oak, they came face to face with 3 men pulling a load of firewood in an ox cart, with no way for either to get around. There had been nothing for it but to wait until the foresters unhitched their ox, led him through the trees, spun the cart, hitched the ox up again, and started back the way they'd come. The ox was even slower than the wagons, so that day they hardly got anywhere at all. Arya could not help looking over her shoulder, wondering when the gold cloaks would catch them. At night, she woke at every noise to grab for Needle's hilt. They never made camp without putting out sentries now, but Arya did not trust them, especially the orphan boys. They might have done well enough in the alleys of King's Landing, but out here they were lost. When she was being quiet as a shadow, she could sneak past all of them, flitting out by starlight to make her water in the woods where no one would see. Once when Lummy Greenhands had the watch, she shimmied up an oak and moved from tree to tree until she was right above his head, and he never saw a thing. She would have jumped down on top of him, but she knew his scream would wake the whole camp, and Yoren might take a stick to her again. Lummy and the other orphans all treated the bull like someone special now, because the queen wanted his head, though he would have none of it.
"I never did nothing to no queen," he said angrily. "I did my work, is all. Bellows and tongs and fetch and carry. I was supposed to be an armourer, and one day Master Mutt says I got to join the nice watch. That's all I know."
Then he'd go off to polish his helm. It was a beautiful helm, rounded and curved, with a slit visor and two great metal bull's horns. Arya would watch him polish the metal with an oilcloth, shining it so bright you could see the flames of the cook fire reflected in the steel. Yet he never actually put it on his head.
"I'll bet he's that traitor's bastard," Lummy said one night in a hushed voice, so Gendry would not hear. "The Wolf Lord, the one they nicked on Baelor Steps."
"He is not," Arya declared. "My father had only one bastard, and that's John." She stalked off into the trees, wishing she could just saddle a horse and ride home. She was a good horse, a chestnut mare with a white blaze on her forehead, and Arya had always been a good rider. She could gallop off and never see any of them unless she wanted to. Only then she'd have no one to scout ahead of her, or watch behind, or stand guard while she napped, and when the gold cloaks caught her, she'd be all alone. It was safer to stay with Yoren and the others.
"We're not far from God's Eye," the Black Brother said one morning. "The King's Road won't be safe till we're across the Trident. So we'll come up around the lake, along the western shore. They're not like to look for us there."
At the next spot, where two ruts cut cross each other, he turned the wagons west. Here, farmland gave way to forest. The villages and holdfasts were smaller and farther apart, the hills higher and the valleys deeper. Food grew harder to come by. In the city, Yoren had loaded up the wagons with salt fish, hard bread, lard, turnips, sacks of beans and barley, and wheels of yellow cheese. But every bite of it had been eaten. Forced to live off the land, Yoren turned to Koss and Kurz, who had been taken as poachers. He would send them ahead of the column into the woods, and come dusk they would be back with a deer slung between them on a pole, or a brace of quail swinging from their belts. The younger boys would be set to picking blackberries along the road, or climbing fences to fill a sack with apples if they happened upon an orchard. Arya was a skilled climber and a fast picker, and she'd like to go off by herself. One day, she came across a rabbit, purely by happenstance. It was brown and fat, with long ears and a twitchy nose. Rabbits ran faster than cats, but they couldn't climb trees half so well. She whacked it with her stick and grabbed it by its ears, and Yoren stewed it with some mushrooms and wild onions. Arya was given a whole leg, since it was her rabbit. She shared it with Gendry. The rest of them each got a spoonful, even the three in manacles. Jake and Hagar thanked her politely for the treat, and Biter licked the grease off his dirty fingers with a blissful look. But Rorg, the noseless one, only laughed and said,
There's a hunter now. Lumpy face, lumpy head, rabbit killer.
Outside a Hothar's called Briar White, some field hands surrounded them in a cornfield, demanding coin for the ears they had taken. Yoren eyed their scythes and tossed them a few coppers.
Time was, a man in black was feasted from dawn to Winterfell, and even high lords called it an honour to shelter him under their roofs, he said bitterly. Now cravens like you want hard coin for a bite of wormy apple, he spat.
It's sweet corn, better than a stinking old blackbird like you deserves, one of them answered roughly. You get out of our field now and take these sneaks and stabbers with you, or we'll stake you up in the corn to scare the other crows away.
They roasted the sweet corn in the husk that night, turning the ears with long forked sticks, and ate it hot right off the cob. Arya thought it tasted wonderful, but Yoren was too angry to eat. A cloud seemed to hang over him, ragged and black as his cloak. He paced about the camp, restlessly, muttering to himself. The next day, Coz came racing back to warn Yoren of a camp ahead.
20 or 30 men in mail and half helms, he said. Some of them are cut up bad, and one's dying from the sound of him. With all the noise he was making, I got right up close. They got spears and shields, but only one horse, and that's lame. I think they've been there a while, from the stink of the place. See a banner? A spotted tree cat, yellow and black, on a mud-brown field.
Yoren folded a sour leaf into his mouth and chewed.
Can't see, he admitted. Might be one side, might be t'other. If they're hurt that bad, likely they'll take our mounts no matter who they are. Might be they'll take more than that. I believe we'll go wide around them.
It took them miles out of their way and cost them 2 days at the least, but the old man said it was cheap at the price.
You'll have time enough on the wall. The rest of your lives, most like. Seems to me there's no rush to get there.
Arya saw men guarding the fields more and more when they turned north again. Often they stood silently beside the road, giving a cold eye to anyone who passed. Elsewhere they patrolled on horses, riding their fence lines with axes strapped to their saddles. At one place, she spotted a man perched up a dead tree, with a bow in his hand and a quiver hanging from the branch beside him. The moment he spied them, he notched an arrow to his bowstring and never looked away until the last wagon was out of sight. All the while, Yoren cursed.
Him in his tree. Let's see how well he likes it up there when the others come to take him. He'll scream for the watch then, that he will.
A day later, Dobber spied a red glow against the evening sky.
Either this road went and turned again, or that sun's setting in the north.
Yoren climbed a rise to get a better look.
Fire,
he announced. He licked a thumb and held it up.
Wind should blow it away from us. Still bears watching.
And watch it they did. As the world darkened, the fire seemed to grow brighter and brighter until it looked as though the whole north was ablaze. From time to time, they could even smell the smoke, though the wind held steady and the flames never got any closer. By dawn, the fire had burned itself out, but none of them slept very well that night. It was midday when they arrived at the place where the village had been. The fields were a charred desolation for miles around. The houses blackened shells. The carcasses of burnt and butchered animals dotted the ground, under living blankets of carrion crows that rose, cawing furiously when disturbed. Smoke still drifted from inside the Holdfast. Its timber palisade looked strong from afar, but had not proved strong enough. Riding out in front of the wagons on her horse, Arya saw burnt bodies impaled on sharpened stakes atop the walls, their hands drawn up tight in front of their faces as if to fight off the flames that had consumed them. Yoren called a halt when they were still some distance off and told Arya and the other boys to guard the wagons while he and Murch and Cutjack went in on foot. A flock of ravens rose from inside the walls when they climbed through the broken gate, and the caged ravens in their wagons called out to them with quawks and raucous shrieks. "Should we go in after them?" Arya asked Gendry, after Yoren and the others had been gone a long time.
"Yoren said wait."
Gentry's voice sounded hollow. When Arya turned to look, she saw that he was wearing his helm, all shiny steel and great curving horns. When they finally returned, Yoren had a little girl in his arms, and Murch and Cutjack were carrying a woman in a sling made of old torn quilt. The girl was no older than two, and she cried all the time. A whimpery sound, like something was caught in her throat. Either she couldn't talk yet, or she had forgotten how. The woman's right arm ended in a bloody stump at her elbow, and her eyes didn't seem to see anything, even when she was looking right at it. She talked, but she only said one thing.
"Please," she cried, over and over. "Please, please."
Rorg thought that was funny. He laughed through the hole in his face where his nose had been, and Biter started laughing too, until Murch cursed them and told them to shut up. Yoren had them fix the woman a place in the back of a wagon.
"And be quick about it," he said. "Come dark, there'll be wolves here, and worse."
"I'm scared,"
Hot Pie murmured when he saw the one-armed woman thrashing in the wagon.
"Me too," Arya confessed. He squeezed her shoulder.
"I never truly kicked no boy to death, Harry. I just sold my mummy's pies, is all."
Arya rode as far ahead of the wagons as she dared, so she wouldn't have to hear the little girl crying or listen to the woman whisper, "Please." She remembered a story old Nan had told her once about a man imprisoned in a dark castle by evil giants. He was very brave and smart, and he tricked the giants and escaped. But no sooner was he outside the castle than the others took him and drank his hot red blood. Now she knew how he must have felt. The one-armed woman died at evenfall. Gendry and Cutjack dug her grave on a hillside beneath a weeping willow. When the wind blew, Arya thought she could hear the long trailing branches whispering,
"Please, please, please."
The little hairs on the back of her neck rose, and she almost ran from the graveside.
"No fire tonight,"
Yoren told them. Supper was a handful of wild radishes Koss found, a cup of dried beans, water from a nearby brook. The water had a funny taste to it, and Lummi told them it was a taste of bodies rotting someplace upstream. Hot Pie would have hit him if old Rayson hadn't pulled them apart. Arya drank too much water, just to fill her belly with something. She never thought she'd be able to sleep, yet somehow she did. When she woke, it was pitch black, and her bladder was full to bursting. Sleepers huddled all around her, wrapped in blankets and cloaks. Arya found Needle, stood, listened. She heard the soft footfalls of a sentry, men turning in restless sleep, Rorg's rattling snores, and the queer hissing sound that Biter made when he slept. From a different wagon came the steady, rhythmic scrape of steel on stone as Yoren sat, chewing sour leaf and sharpening the edge of his dirk. Hot Pie was one of the boys on watch.
"Where you going?"
he asked when he saw Arya heading for the trees. Arya waved vaguely at the wood.
"No, you're not,"
Hot Pie said. He had gotten bolder again now that he had a sword on his belt, even though it was just a short sword, and he handled it like a cleaver.
"The old man said for everyone to stay close tonight." "I need to make water," Arya explained. "Well, use that tree right there," he pointed. "You don't know what's out there, Harry. I heard wolves before."
Yoren wouldn't like it if she fought with him. She tried to look afraid, Wolves? For true? I heard, he assured her. I don't think I need to go after all. She went back to her blanket and pretended to sleep until she heard Hot Pie's footsteps going away. Then she rolled over, slipped off into the woods on the other side of the camp, quiet as a shadow. There were sentries out this way too, but Arya had no trouble avoiding them. Just to make sure, she went out twice as far as usual. When she was sure that there was no one near, she skinned down her breeches and squatted to do her business. She was making water, her clothing tangled about her ankles, when she heard rustling from under the trees. Hot Pie, she thought in panic. He followed me. Then she saw the eyes shining from the wood, bright with reflected moonlight. Her belly clenched tight as she grabbed for needle, not caring if she pissed herself, counting eyes. 2, 4, 8, 12, a whole pack. One of them came padding out from under the trees. He stared at her and bared his teeth. And all she could think was how stupid she'd been and how Hot Pie would gloat when they found her half-eaten body the next morning. But the wolf turned and raced back into the darkness, and quick as that, the eyes were gone. Trembling, she cleaned herself and laced up and followed a distant scraping sound back to camp and to Yoren. Arya climbed up into the wagon beside him, shaken.
Wolves, she whispered hoarsely, in the woods.
Aye, they would be.
He never looked at her.
They scared me, did they?
He spat.
Seems to me your kind was fond of wolves.
Nymeria was a dire wolf. Arya hugged herself. That's different. Anyhow, she's gone. Jory and I threw rocks at her until she ran off, or else the queen would have killed her. It made her sad to talk about it.
I'll bet if she'd been in the city, she wouldn't have let them cut off father's head.
Orphan boys got no fathers,
Yoren said.
Or did you forget that?
The sour leaf had turned his spit red, so it looked like his mouth was bleeding.
The only wolves we've got to fear are the ones we're manskin, like those who done for that village.
I wish I was home, she said miserably. She tried so hard to be brave, to be fierce as a wolverine and all, but sometimes she felt like she was just a little girl after all. The black brother peeled a fresh sour leaf from the bale in the wagon and stuffed it into his mouth.
Might be. I should have left you where I found you, boy. All of you. Safer in the city, seems to me.
I don't care. I want to go home.
Been bringing men to the war for close on 30 years.
Froth shone on Yoren's lips like bubbles of blood.
All that time, I only lost 3. Old man died of a fever. City boy got snake bite, taking a shit. And one fool tried to kill me in my sleep and got a red smile for his trouble.
He drew a dirk across his throat to show her.
3 in 30 years.
He spat out the sour leaf.
A ship now. Might have been wiser. No chance of finding more men on the way, but still. Clever man, he'd go by ship. But me? 30 years. I've been taking this king's road.
He sheathed his dirk.
Go to sleep, boy. Hear me?
She did try. Yet as she lay under her thin blanket, she could hear the wolves howling. And another sound, fainter. No more than a whisper on the wind. That might have been screams. Davos. The morning air was dark with the smoke of burning gods. They were all afire now. Maid and mother, warrior and smith, the crone with her pearl eyes, and the father with his gilded beard. Even the stranger carved to look more animal than human. The old dry wood and countless layers of paint and varnish
blazed with a fierce, hungry light. Heat rose shimmering through the chill air. Behind, the gargoyles and stone dragons on the castle wall seemed blurred, as if Davos was seeing them through a veil of tears, or as if the beasts were trembling, stirring. "An ill thing," Allard declared, though at least he had the sense to keep his voice low. Dale muttered agreement.
"Silence," said Davos. "Remember where you are."
His sons were good men, but young, and Allard especially was rash.
"Had I stayed a smuggler, Allard would have ended on the wall. Stannis spared him from that end. Something else I owe him."
Hundreds had come to the castle gates to bear witness to the burning of the Seven. The smell in the air was ugly. Even for soldiers, it was hard not to feel uneasy at such an affront to the gods most had worshipped all their lives. The Red Woman walked round the fire three times, praying once in the speech of a Shai, once in High Valyrian, and once in the common tongue. Davos understood only the last.
"R'hllor, come to us in our darkness," she called. "Lord of Light, we offer you these false gods, these Seven who are one, and him the enemy. Take them and cast your light upon us, for the night is dark and full of terrors."
Queen Selyse echoed the words. Beside her, Stannis watched impassively, his jaw hard as stone under the blue-black shadow of his tight-cropped beard. He had dressed more richly than was his wont, as if for the Sept. Dragonstone's Sept had been where Aegon the Conqueror knelt to pray the night before he sailed. That had not saved it from the Queen's men. They had overturned the altars, pulled down the statues, and smashed the stained glass with war hammers. Sept and Bar could only curse them, but Sir Hubbard Rampton led his three sons to the Sept to defend their gods. The Ramptons had slain four of the Queen's men before the others overwhelmed them. Afterward, Gunsir Sunglass, mildest and most pious of lords, told Stannis he could no longer support his claim. Now he shared a sweltering cell with the Septon and Sir Hubbard's two surviving sons. The other lords had not been slow to take the lesson. The guards had never meant much to Davos the smuggler, though like most men, he had been known to make offerings to the warrior before battle, to the smith when he launched a ship, and to the mother whenever his wife grew great with child. He felt ill as he watched them burn, and not only from the smoke.
"Maester Cressin would have stopped this."
The old man had challenged the Lord of Light and been struck down for his impiety, or so the gossips told each other. Davos knew the truth. He had seen the maester slip something into the wine cup.
"Poison. What else could it be? He drank a cup of death to free Stannis from Melisandre, but somehow her god shielded her."
He would gladly have killed the Red Woman for that, yet what chance would he have where a maester of the Citadel had failed? He was only a smuggler, raised high. Davos of Flea Bottom, the Onion Knight. The burning guards cast a pretty light, wreathed in their robes of shifting flame, red and orange and yellow. Septon Bar had once told Davos how they'd been carved from the masts of the ships that had carried the first Targaryens from Valyria. Over the centuries, they had been painted and repainted, gilded, silvered, jeweled.
"Their beauty will make them more pleasing to R'hllor,"
Melisandre said when she told Stannis to pull them down and drag them out the castle gates. The maiden lay athwart the warrior, her arms widespread as if to embrace him. The mother seemed almost to shudder as the flames came licking up her face. A long sword had been thrust through her heart, and its leather grip was alive with flame. The father was on the bottom, the first to fall. Davos watched the hand of the stranger writhe and curl as the fingers blackened and fell away one by one,
reduced to so much glowing charcoal. Nearby, Lord Celtigar coughed fitfully and covered his wrinkled face with a square of linen embroidered in red crabs. The mermen swapped jokes as they enjoyed the warmth of the fire, but young Lord Bar-Eamon had turned a splotchy grey, and Lord Valarion was watching the king rather than the conflagration. Darvas would have given much to know what he was thinking, but one such as Valarion would never confide in him. The Lord of the Tides was of the blood of ancient Valeria, and his house had thrice provided brides for Tregarian princes. Davos Seaworth stank of fish and onions. It was the same with the other lordlings. He could trust none of them, nor would they ever include him in their private councils. They scorned his sons as well.
My grandsons will joust with theirs, though, and one day their blood may wed with mine. In time, my little black ship will fly as high as Valarian Seahorse or Celtigar's Red Crabs.
That is, if Stannis won his throne. If he lost...
Everything I am, I owe to him.
Stannis had raised him to knighthood. He'd given him a place of honor at his table. A war galley to sail in place of a smuggler's skiff. Dale and Allard captained galleys as well. Merrick was oarmaster on the Fury. Matha served his father on Black Betha, and the king had taken Devon as a royal squire. One day he would be knighted, and the two little lads as well. Maria was mistress of a small keep on Cape Wrath, with servants who called her milady, and Davos could hunt red deer in his own woods. All this he had of Stannis Baratheon, for the price of a few finger joints.
It was just what he did to me. I had flouted the king's laws all my life. He has earned my loyalty.
Davos touched the little pouch that hung from the leather thong about his neck. His fingers were his luck, and he needed luck now.
As do we all, Lord Stannis most of all.
Pale flames licked at the grey sky. Dark smoke rose, twisting and curling. When the wind pushed it toward them, men blinked and wept and rubbed their eyes. Allard turned his head away, coughing and cursing.
A taste of things to come, thought Davos.
Many and more would burn before this war was done. Melisande was robed all in scarlet satin and blood velvet, her eyes as red as the great ruby that glistened at her throat, as if it too were a fire. In ancient books of Ashai, it is written that there will come a day after a long summer when the stars bleed and the cold breath of darkness falls heavy on the world. In this dread hour, a warrior shall draw from the fire a burning sword, and that sword shall be Lightbringer, the red sword of heroes. And he who clasps it shall be Azor Ahai come again, and the darkness shall flee before him. She lifted her voice, so it carried out over the gathered host. Azor Ahai, beloved R'hllor, the warrior of light, the son of fire, come forth, your sword awaits you. Come forth and take it into your hand. Stannis Baratheon strode forth like a soldier marching into battle. His squire stepped up to attend him. Davos watched as his son Devon pulled a long padded glove over the king's right hand. The boy wore a cream-colored doublet with a fiery heart sewn on the breast. Brian Farring was similarly garbed as he tied a stiff leather cape around his grace's neck. Behind, Davos heard a faint clank and clatter of bells.
Under the sea, smoke rises in bubbles, and flames burn green and blue and black.
Patchface sang somewhere.
I know, oh ho ho.
The king plunged into the fire with his teeth clenched, holding the leather cloak before him to keep off the flames.
He went straight to the mother, grasped the sword with his gloved hand, and wrenched it free of the burning wood with a single hard jerk. Then he was retreating, the sword held high, jade-green flames swirling around cherry-red steel. Guards rushed to beat out the cinders that clung to the king's clothing.
"A sword of fire!"
shouted Queen Selyse. Sir Axel Florent and the other queen's men took up the cry.
"A sword of fire! It burns! It burns! A sword of fire!"
Melisandre lifted her hands above her head.
"Behold, a sign was promised, and now a sign is seen. Behold, Lightbringer! Azor Ahai has come again. All hail the warrior of light. All hail the son of fire."
A ragged wave of shouts gave answer, just as Stannis's glove began to smolder. Cursing, the king thrust the point of the sword into the damp earth and beat out the flames against his leg.
"Lord, cast your light upon us," Melisandre called out.
"For the night is dark and full of terrors," Selyse and her queen's men replied.
"Should I speak the words as well?" Davos wondered. "Do I owe Stannis that much? Is this fiery god truly his own?"
His shortened fingers twitched. Stannis peeled off the glove and let it fall to the ground. The guards on the pyre were scarcely recognizable anymore. The head fell off the smith with a puff of ash and embers. Melisandre sang in the tongue of a Shai, her voice rising and falling like the tides of the sea. Stannis untied his singed leather cape and listened in silence. Thrust in the ground, Lightbringer still glowed ruddy hot, but the flames that clung to the sword were dwindling and dying. By the time the song was done, only Charwood remained of the gods, and the king's patience had run its course. He took the queen by the elbow and escorted her back into Dragonstone, leaving Lightbringer where it stood. The Red Woman remained a moment to watch as Devon knelt with Brian Faring and rolled up the burnt and blackened sword in the king's leather cloak.
"The Red Sword of Heroes looks a proper mess," thought Davos.
A few of the lords lingered to speak in quiet voices upwind of the fire. They fell silent when they saw Davos looking at them.
"Should Stannis fall, they will pull me down in an instant."
Neither was he counted one of the Queen's men, that group of ambitious knights and minor lordlings who had given themselves to this Lord of Light and so won the favor and patronage of Lady.
"No, Queen, remember? Selyse."
The fire had started to dwindle by the time Melisandre and the squires departed with the precious sword. Davos and his sons joined the crowd, making its way down to the shore and the waiting ships.
"Devon acquitted himself well," he said as they went.
"He fetched the glove without dropping it, yes," said Dale.
Allard nodded.
"That badge on Devon's doublet, the fiery art, what was that?"
"The Baratheon sigil is a crown stag."
"A lord can choose more than one badge," Davos said.
Dale smiled. "A black ship and an onion, father?" Allard kicked at a stone. "The others take our onion and that flaming heart. It was an ill thing to burn the seven."
"When did you grow so devout?" Davos asked. "What does a smuggler's son know of the doings of gods?"
"I'm a knight's son, father. If you won't remember, why should they?"
"A knight's son, but not a knight," Davos said. "Nor will you ever be, if you meddle in affairs that do not concern you. Stannis is our rightful king. It's not for us to question him. We sail his ships and do his bidding, that is all."
"As to that, father," Dale said, "I must light these water casks they've given me for Wraith. Green pine. The water will spoil on a voyage of any length."
"I got the same for Lady Maria," said Allard. "The Queen's men have laid claims to all the seasoned wood."
"I will speak to the king about it," Davos promised.
Better it come from him
than from Allard. His sons were good fighters and better sailors, but they did not know how to talk to lords.
They were low-born, even as I was, but they do not like to recall that. When they look at our banner, all they see is a tall black ship flying on the wind. They close their eyes to the onion.
The port was as crowded as Davos had ever known it. Every dock teemed with sailors loading provisions, and every inn was packed with soldiers dicing or drinking or looking for a haul. A vain search, since Stannis permitted none on his island. Ships lined the strand, war galleys and fishing vessels, stout carracks and fat-bottom cogs. The best berths had been taken by the larger vessels. Stannis's flagship, Fury, rocking between Lord Stephen and Stag of the Sea. Lord Valerian's silver-hulled Pride of Driftmark and her three sisters. Lord Seldegar's ornate red claw. The ponderous swordfish with her long iron prow. Out to sea at anchor rode Salador Sarn's great Valerian, amidst the striped hulls of 24 smaller Lycene galleys. A weathered little inn sat on the end of the stone pier, where Black Betha, Wraith, and Lady Maria shared mooring space with a half dozen other galleys of 100 oars or less. Davos had a thirst. He took his leave of his sons and turned his steps toward the inn. Up front squatted a waist-high gargoyle, so eroded by rain and salt that his features were all but obliterated. He and Davos were old friends, though. He gave a pat to the stone head as he went in.
Luck, he murmured.
Across the noisy common room, Salador Sarn sat eating grapes from a wooden bowl. When he spied Davos, he beckoned him closer.
Sir Knight, come sit with me, eh? Eat a grape. Eat two. They are marvelously sweet.
The Lycene was a sleek, smiling man whose flamboyance was a byword on both sides of the narrow sea. Today he wore flashing cloth of silver, with dagged sleeves so long the ends of them pooled on the floor. His buttons were carved jade monkeys, and atop his wispy white curls perched a jaunty green cap decorated with a fan of peacock feathers. Davos threaded his way through the tables to a chair. In the days before his knighthood, he had often bought cargoes from Salador Sarn. The Lycene was a smuggler himself, as well as a trader, a banker, a notorious pirate, and the self-styled Prince of the Narrow Sea.
When a pirate grows rich enough, they make him a prince.
It had been Davos who had made the journey to Lys to recruit the old rogue to Lord Stannis's cause.
You did not see the gods burn, my lord, he asked. The Red Priests have a great temple on Lys. Always they are burning this and burning that, crying out to their R'hllor. They bore me with their fires. Soon they will bore King Stannis too, it is to be hoped.
He seemed utterly unconcerned that someone might overhear him, eating his grapes and dribbling the seeds out onto his lip, flicking them off with a finger.
My bird of 1,000 colors came in yesterday, good sir. She is not a warship, no, but a trader, and she paid a call on King's Landing. Are you sure you will not have a grape? Huh? Children go hungry in the city, it is said.
He dangled the grapes before Davos and smiled.
A tail I need, and nose. The men of Westeros are ever rushing, eh?
Complained Salador Sarn.
What good is this, I ask you? He who hurries through life hurries to his grave. He belched. The Lord of Castellirock has sent his dwarf to see to King's Landing. Perhaps he hopes that his ugly face will frighten off attackers, eh? Or that we will laugh ourselves dead when the imp capers on the battlements. Who can say, eh? The dwarf has chased off the lout who ruled the Goldcloaks
and put in his place a knight with an iron hand.
He plucked a grape and squeezed it between thumb and forefinger until the skin burst, juice ran down between his fingers. A serving girl pushed her way through, swatting at the hands that groped her as she passed. Davos ordered a tankard of ale, turned back to Sarn and said,
"How well is the city defended?"
The other shrugged.
The walls are high and strong, but who will man them? They are building scorpions and spitfires. Oh, yes, but the men in the gold cloaks are too few and too green, and there are no others. A swift strike, like a hawk plummeting at a hare, and the great city will be ours. Grant us wind to fill our sails, and your king could sit upon his iron throne by evenfall on the morrow. We could dress the dwarf in motley, and prick his little cheeks with the points of our spears to make him dance for us. And mayhaps your goodly king would make me a gift of the beautiful Queen Cersei to warm my bed for a night. I have been too long away from my wives, and all in his service. Pirate, said Davos, you have no wives, only concubines, and you have been well paid for every day and every ship. Only in promises, said Salador Sarn mournfully. Good sir, it is gold I crave, not words and papers.
He popped a grape into his mouth.
You'll have your gold when we take the treasury in King's Landing. No man in the Seven Kingdoms is more honorable than Stannis Baratheon. He will keep his word.
Even as Davos spoke, he thought,
this world is twisted beyond hope, when low-born smugglers must vouch for the honor of kings. And so he has said and said, and so I say, let us do this thing, eh? Even these grapes could be no more ripe than that city, my old friend.
The serving girl returned with his ale. Davos gave her a copper.
Might be we could take King's Landing, as you say,
he said as he lifted the tankard.
But how long would we hold it? Tywin Lannister is known to be at Harrenhal with a great host. And Lord Renly... Yes, the young brother, eh?
Said Salador Sarn.
That putt is not so good, my friend. King Renly bestirs himself. No, here... He is Lord Renly, my pardons. So many kings, my tongue grows weary of the word. The brother Renly has left Highgarden with his fair young queen, his flowered lords and shining knights, and a mighty host of foot. He marches up your road of roses toward the very same great city we are speaking of. He takes his bride?
The other shrugged.
He did not tell me why. Perhaps he is loath to part with the warm burrow between her thighs, eh? Even for a night. Or perhaps he is that certain of his victory. The king must be told. I have attended to it, good sir, though his grace frowns so whenever he does see me that I tremble to come before him. Do you think he would like me better if I wore a hair shirt and never smiled, eh? Well, I will not do it. I am an honest man. He must suffer me in silk and samite, or else I shall take my ships where I am better loved. That sword was not Lightbringer, my friend.
The sudden shift in subject left Davos uneasy.
Sword? A sword plucked from fire, yes. Men tell me things. It is my pleasant smile. How shall a burnt sword serve Stannis? A burning sword, corrected Davos. Burnt, said Salladhar Saan, and be glad of that, my friend. Do you know the tale of the forging of Lightbringer? Huh? I shall tell it you. It was a time when darkness lay heavy on the world. To oppose it, the hero must have a hero's blade. Oh, like none that has ever been. And so, for 30 days and 30 nights, Azor-Ahá labored sleepless in the temple, forging a blade in the sacred fires. Heat and hammer and fold. Heat and hammer and fold. Oh, yes, until the sword was done. Yet when he plunged it into water to temper the steel, it burst asunder. Being a hero, it was not for him to shrug and go in search of excellent grapes such as these. So he began again. The second time, he took 50 days and 50 nights, and this sword seemed even finer than the first. Azor-Ahá captured a lion to temper the blade by plunging it through the beast's red heart. But once more, the steel shattered and split. Great was his woe, and great was his sorrow then, for he knew what he must do. 100 days and 100 nights he labored on the third blade, and as it glowed white-hot in the sacred fires, he summoned his wife. Nissa, Nissa, he said to her, for that was her name, bear your breast and know that I love you best of all that is in this world. She did this thing. Why, I cannot say. And Azor-Ahá thrust the smoking sword to her living heart. It is said that her cry of anguish and ecstasy left a crack across the face of the moon. But her blood and her soul and her strength and her courage all went into the steel. Such is the tale of the forging of Lightbringer, the red sword of heroes. Now do you see my meaning? Be glad that it is just a burnt sword that his grace pulled from the fire. Too much light can hurt the eyes, my friend, and fire burns. Salador-san finished the last grape and smacked his lips. When do you think the king will bid us sail, good sir? Soon, I think, said Davos, if his god wills it. His god, eh, sir friend? Not yours. Where is the god of Sir Davos Seaworth, knight of the onion ship?
Davos sipped his ale to give himself a moment.
The inn is crowded, and you are not Salador-san, he reminded himself. Be careful how you answer. King Stannis is my god. He made me and blessed me with his trust. I will remember. Salador-san got to his feet. My pardons. These grapes have given me a hunger, eh? And dinner awaits me on my Valerian. Minced lamb with pepper and roasted gull stuffed with mushrooms and fennel and onion. Soon we shall eat together in King's Landing. Yes? In the Red Keep we shall feast, while the dwarf sings us a jolly tune. When you speak to King Stannis, mention, if you would, that he will owe me another 30,000 dragons come the black of the moon. He ought to have given those gods to me. They were too beautiful to burn, and might have brought a noble price in Pentos or Myrrh. Well, if he grants me Queen Cersei for a night, oh, I shall forgive him.
The Lysine clapped Davos on the back and swaggered from the inn as if he owned it. Sir Davos Seaworth lingered over his tankard for a good while, thinking. A year ago, he had been with Stannis in King's Landing when King Robert staged a tourney for Prince Joffrey's name day. He remembered the Red Priest, Thoros of Myrrh, and the flaming sword he had wielded in the melee. The man had made a colorful spectacle, his red robes flapping, while his blade writhed with pale green flames. But everyone knew there was no true magic in it, and in the end his fire had gutted out, and Bronze Jon Royce had brained him with a common mace.
A true sword of fire, no, that would be a wonder to behold, yet at such a cost.
When he thought of Nissa, Nissa, it was his own Maria he pictured, a good-natured plump woman with sagging breasts
and a kindly smile. The best woman in the world. He tried to picture himself driving a sword through her and shuddered.
I am not made of the stuff of heroes, he decided.
If that